Friends and enemies, welcome to Bad Voltage. What the hell episode is it?
I like the energy.
Three.
I don't like the memory, but I like the energy. You just blasted.
Okay.
Full speed ahead. Don't know the episode. Don't know the season.
No, don't stop recording. Keep going.
We're not friends and enemies. Oh, no, we're not.
We're not using
it.
We're not using
it. This is going in the show.
Welcome to Bad Voltage Season 3, Episode 3, which we were going to call Jeremy Voltage because apparently Jeremy knows all the things about all the things we're talking about. But but we decided, how does that differ from any other show? So, right. Dotto, Jeremy, yeah. How are you, chaps?
Oh, living the dream.
Living the dream. The lock-in dream.
Yeah, although I've discovered that Zoom phone calls have become quite dangerous. Having last weekend did a Zoom video session with Jeremy and Alan and a few other people and woke up the following the morning enormously hungover, which I've never experienced with a Zoom session before.
No,
the virtual world.
Turns out Walnut Creek, the lock-in edition, same as Walnut Creek.
Virtual pub's a good idea.
All right.
It really is.
Yeah. But people, I like how people are doing interesting things. Like, you know, people are doing cocktail classes and hanging out with their friends. And Eric and I have both said, you know, why didn't we do this beforehand? Like, why don't we just hang out with people on Zoom on a Saturday night?
Stuff to do and places to go and people to see.
Well, we had the outside available.
Yeah, because you didn't have to. I mean, yes, I like the virtual pub, but much like virtual reality, actual reality is better.
There is no substitute for the welly, it turns out.
There really
this
isn't.
Is,
yeah, I said it because it's true. Love that place.
Oh, man, I missed it.
This is true. All right, and now this pile of bollocks. Okay, so we've got some gems for you this week. So it turns out this first one was suggested by Stuart, is that it's possible that the MMR vaccine may help to protect you from coronavirus. This isn't actually funny in itself, but Stuart just wanted to give anti-vaxxers a kick. Yeah, so
where's the comedic value in this one? I'm confused.
Basically, I just read the headline and just laughed out loud. I mean, I shouldn't really. It's a very unkind approach for me to take, but, you know, that's what you get, okay? So, sucks to be you, I guess. Anti-vaxxers, get coronavirus.
And welcome to the new show, Shut In, Brum Edition.
I was having a conversation with someone last weekend, I think it was, who was saying that, I forget which one it was, but one of the injections that we used to get as a kid in England, the one with all of the dots, you don't get anymore in the US. People don't give it anymore in the US. Which one was that? One with all of the dots?
Yeah.
That wasn't the MMR, was it?
Because it gave you a scar on your upper arm. No, it was...
Still got it, yeah.
Smallpox or something?
Something like that.
I don't remember, but yeah, loads of people got it.
Apparently, a lot of people don't get that anymore, so...
My mum told me a story that apparently someone was complaining that they haven't come up with a vaccine yet for COVID-19 because it should be really easy because it's like the 19th one and they should have practiced on the first 18.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, okay, that's depressing.
We're going to need a bigger rocket, people.
Okay, the media could do a better job perhaps of explaining this kind of thing. But yes, next thing.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so apparently there is a patent that is titled Cryptocurrency System for Using Body Activity Data. And this patent basically says that the energy for mining cryptocurrency could be generated from a brainwave, which is obviously not present in the people you were just referring to, or body heat when a human being performs simple tasks such as watching an advertisement. As per the patent, depending on whether you can speak English or not, Microsoft has planned to use a variety of sensors like thermal sensors, heart rate sensors, fMRI sensors. Is that right or is that a typo?
No, that's correct.
It's correct.
Okay.
Functional magnetic resonance imagery.
You buffing. NIRS sensors, sensors, and cameras to measure the heat generated from the human body. So basically, this means that you could be sat on your ass watching Two and a Half Men reruns, and you could be mining Bitcoin.
So, as far as I can tell, implanting devices into your body so that even your waste body heat is used to mine cryptocurrency is the most cyberpunk thing I have ever heard of.
I would not have predicted the transition for Bitcoin would have been start with CPUs. CPUs aren't good enough. Switch to GPUs. GPUs aren't good enough. Switch to ASICs. And then after ASIC, body heat. That was not the transition I saw.
It's honestly, I mean, just imagine in your head, if you will, a picture of Morpheus going, can turn a human being into this and holding a battery out. That's literally what this is. It's not even a joke anymore.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but is I'm a little concerned.
Yeah, but is this going to be like sticking a solar panel on a roof in Coventry? I mean, it's not going to work really very well. Sorry, yeah. Coventry again.
I was going to say, a pattern is forming here.
Yeah, I don't know. Also, a friend of mine, Joey Hess, moved to Coventry, I just discovered recently. And
Based on your glowing recommendation, I assume?
Yeah. Well, he was already in England. I didn't realize he'd moved to Coventry. And he's like the most American person you've ever met. So he's almost certainly rampaging Coventry as we speak.
He must have done something very bad in a previous life.
He was born, if that counts. All right, let's move on. So apparently, like in these moments of coronavirus, we all have had to make sacrifices. We've all had to put aside our comforts to join in with the cause. And our good friends in Belgium have been urged to eat fries twice a week because apparently the coronavirus has created a massive potato surplus. Now, just the words massive potato surplus in itself is enough for me for this headline, let alone Belgium's been eating. I mean, I want to move to Belgium. That sounds amazing.
I feel positively Belgian having read this. I'm like, okay, I will throw myself on the sword of eating chips one extra time a week. No worries, Belgians. Thanks very much.
I love the description of the surplus, too. It was not only are there 750,000 tons of potatoes, but that is enough to fill 30,000 fairly large lorries. Which is how they described it verbatim.
Yeah, it's very difficult to visualize massive quantities of potatoes, apparently. Massive quantities of potatoes could be the name of the show. And then finally, and some of you may have glanced over this in the news, apparently you shouldn't eat or inject yourself with disinfectant, warns the FDA commissioner. So this is all kinds of stupid.
It's okay, because suggesting it was apparently just sarcasm.
Sarcasm towards reporters, by the way. But sarcasm towards reporters that you're not looking at.
Apparently the number of calls to local health lines around America has peaked rather a lot from people ringing up going, are we really supposed to do the bleach thing? Seriously? And obviously every medical professional in the whole country is going, no, you're not supposed to do it. I don't care what you saw on television. Don't do that.
So this is the problem I have with the story. One, he didn't really say go and drink bleach. He kind of does what he always does, which is basically waffles incoherently about something. But two, even if he did say go and drink bleach, like, American people, I want you to go right now, pick up your Lysol and consume it. Even if he did say that. Come on, America. Are you so stupid to not realize that will be bad for you? This really is survival of the fittest in its finest order. So it's not a good idea. Don't drink bleach.
I concur. Do we have any more serious news?
We do. Do you want to tell us the serious news, or does Jeremy, or do I have to do it?
I'll do this one. This was an interesting a survey done in the UK of IT professionals, and apparently 74% of them, 74% of us, are getting less than the recommended 7 to 8 hours of sleep per night, and a quarter of the sample said they got 3 to 4 hours of sleep a night.
Really?
That's really low. I mean,
is really low.
I mean, admittedly, I suspect a bunch of these people are 22 and therefore can cope with 4 hours sleep a night, which we're probably not able to do anymore. But nonetheless, it's they're talking about half of all IT professionals are taking brief naps during the day or feeling really unmotivated and error prone and less happy about it and everything. Although apparently, would you believe it, 2/3 of people at director CIO level, they are satisfied with their work-life balance. Would you believe it? I was quite surprised to hear that. But the thing which brought this to mind is not just the rather depressing statistic that we're not getting enough sleep and we really ought to do better at work-life balance. It's the proposed solution to this from the people who published the survey, which is they suggest that the way you solve this problem is adoption of cloud technologies.
So here's where you put this in the serious column, and I can't tell if you're taking a piss or if this is a thing.
It's possible that they're taking a piss, but the people who wrote this thing said there's a positive link between the adoption of cloud technologies and people's work-life balance, with 57% of those whose organisations have embraced cloud technologies feeling satisfied with their work-life balance. And maybe there's some kind of a point to be made about having to do less work when you outsource a bunch of it to the cloud or whatever. But tacking it on the end of... and we might disagree with that anyway. But tacking that on the end of a survey saying people aren't getting enough sleep makes it sound a great deal like their proposal for the fact that your kid woke you up 3 times last week is to go to work and adopt Kubernetes.
I would think a slightly different reason behind this.
Okay.
I would say the overlap between the type of company that is willing to adopt newer technologies, cloud just happened to be newer technology, and the kind of companies that will promote a good like work-life balance are high, where super traditional companies where like work is everything probably are not adopting cloud. So I don't think it's a result of the cloud. I think it's a result of the kind of culture that would adopt a cloud.
It's correlation, not causation.
Correct. Exactly.
Okay, no, I'm prepared by that.
However, to counter that, I think you're right, but to counter that point a little bit, think about all these startups out there who, born and raised in the era of the cloud, and they are just populated by workaholics. I would have thought that would
impact. Self-selecting workaholics, though. Most people who want to work at a startup, that's what they're looking for, in a way.
That's a good point.
I would massively dispute that. I think they're prepared to put up with it. What they're looking for is a swimming pool in Beverly Hills. I don't think anyone goes, you know, what I want to do is work a 19-hour day and sleep under my desk and do a 6-month death march, at which point some CEO founder bloke gets $300 million and I get to go and work at Startup 2. No one wants this. It's what you go get the stuff you do want.
I don't know. This is interesting because I think the kind of people who choose to go and work in the quote-unquote Silicon Valley style businesses, right, and people who are working like that, I actually don't think the money is the big deal.
Well, then why don't they go and dig holes or fix water in Flint or something? If what they want to do is work and they're not bothered about the money, there's loads more valuable stuff you can do than inventing another way of delivering pizza to people's houses.
Because maybe this is just me, but working in a tech startup, I would personally consider to be more fun than, for example, digging a fucking hole. Right? More rewarding, more interesting, pays probably better. I don't know how much hole diggers get paid. But my point is that I think people love the thrill of that lifestyle. They enjoy it. They're entrepreneurial type people and they enjoy kind of like doing all that kind of stuff, even if they don't get the Hollywood guitar-shaped swimming pool. So, I don't know.
Who knows?
My explanation's a little bit longer, but this is a short news segment and I don't have time. If we want to do it as a part of an episode one time, happy to dig into it.
I
think that'd be quite interesting. People out there, if you'd like to hear that, let us know.
Let us know. Go to the Slack channel. And also, good use of the pun, dig into it.
I
tried to sneak that in.
Should we talk about the NHS? So first of all, NHS, wonderful organization, doing a fabulous job right now with COVID-19. But apparently they're taking a slightly different approach to the COVID tracking. Now, we talked, was it last show or the first episode of this season?
Last show, I believe.
About how Google and Apple are baking in some technology into their operating systems to help with contact tracing as part of kind of pandemics. And we both, well, the three of us rather, think that this is pretty cool, and they're doing it in a decentralized way. And look, we, as we said in the show, like, we'd prefer if there wasn't any level of overreach, but sometimes you need to do what you need to do to help deal with a situation such as a pandemic. Apparently, the NHS are taking quite a different approach and are focusing more on a centralized approach to this, where everything will be basically, from what I can tell, sucked into a central server. And then the analysis of the contact tracing will be performed there, which to me sounds like a very bad idea.
Yes, I mean, they're not alone. France have also asked the ability to do this, so on and so forth. The issue is, I mean, there are certain benefits to having it centralized, but the downside of it is that they're being pretty disingenuous about it, because there were memos released where ministers in the UK government said, well, what we want really from this, if we're going to build up this big thing, we want the ability to de-anonymize users. We want to be able to find exactly who people are. And that's precisely the reason this whole thing was designed as decentralized, is so you can't do that. Because once you've got this huge database, no one will ever turn it off. And so Apple and Google and the original DP3T proposal was explicitly designed so that someone can't use it for this.
The thing I find really interesting here is there wasn't a ton of information in this article from a technical perspective, but it is very rare that the United States-centric corporate solution is the super privacy-focused solution, and the European solution is not. It's like the tide-changing thing. I'm very astounded at this.
I have to say, and this is probably be massively unfair to Google, but I'm willing to bet that Apple are one of the major drivers of this. Like, their privacy record has been pretty decent in recent years.
And the details of it are coming out. It's actually kind of an interesting implementation plan. What they plan to do initially is just offer an API that's the same on iOS and on Android before then baking it into the OS level. And you would need to be a government approved app to even access the APIs. And there's anonymous, like, it's multiple points of anonymity throughout the chain in a way that is pretty privacy respecting so far from the details that have come out, which is good to see. They've also both committed to decommissioning the API once this is over, which is also good to see.
Yeah.
Wow. And do we know when it's going to come out?
No.
They want to release the API in next month, I believe, May.
Yeah. Yeah. The answer is soon. But no one's actually announced dates, and obviously apps need to be built on top of it, and so on and so forth. Gonna take a little while.
Big fan.
It is possible to do this kind of thing without Google and Apple cooperation, but because you are sharply limited by what you can do with things like Bluetooth, if you build a third-party app which doesn't integrate with the APIs they're proposing, because you want to collect a bunch of non-necessary data so you've got a massive great big database, for example, then the app will only work if, like, the screen's turned on all the time. And as far as I can tell from reading a bunch of articles about this, the contact tracing stuff works quite well if you get 50% of the country to sign up to it. But most places don't. Singapore got 20%. So it's hard to get that many people to do it.
It is.
Interesting.
So it's going to be interesting to see how this works out, really.
Yeah.
But I am wildly concerned about how a whole bunch of government people seem to be like, I mean, maybe they aren't doing it so they can collect a huge database of information about people, but their behaviour is indistinguishable from someone who does think that. And when you ask them, are you doing that? They don't give a clear and direct no, absolutely not. They say things like, yeah, privacy is really important to us. But then when you say, why are you not using the existing design privacy respecting protocol? They're like, no, we need to collect more data than that. It's like, did you hear the first sentence?
Of course. I mean, it's a government. That's their MO, isn't it? Collecting data on their people. So, of course, that's the way it is. So, all right. Yeah. Let's move on.
So, as we discussed on the last episode, we're going to discuss on this episode digital fiat currency. So Stuart and Jono asked me to do a little bit of a brief intro just to get you up to speed on what we're going to talk about and make sure that we have kind of that common language established, if you will. So what is fiat currency? Fiat currency is government-issued currency that is not backed by a physical commodity like gold or silver, which was the case for most currencies until somewhat recently, but rather by the government that issued it. So the value of fiat currency, to be clear, is derived from the relationship between supply and demand and the stability of the issuing government. And what that really means is there's no intrinsic value. So before, say, when we were under the gold standard, the note was backed by a physical bar of gold somewhere. That is no longer the case. And this is now the case for most modern paper currency, be it in the US or the euro or almost all of them. So because of that, fiat currency gives central banks greater control over the economy because they can print at will how much they would like to print, which would not be the case if they needed to go somehow procure gold, especially in a time like this.
Yeah, because there's a limited amount of gold, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So just to clarify things, what that means is fiat money only has value because the government maintains that value and if both parties on either side of a transaction agree on that value. So it's a lot of trust there. In fact, the word fiat comes from Latin and is translated roughly to it shall be, right?
So. Oh. I thought it was shit automobile.
It's not about the cars. I knew you were going to say that.
You can use fiat currency to buy a fiat. Yes.
All I've got is that one, and fiat stands for found in a tip. That's it. Those are the two fiat jokes that I've got.
Fix it again, Tony.
we have three fiat jokes. Okay.
So now that we understand fiat, what is money really conceptually? And what you want out of money in general is to store value, something that can provide a numerical count, something that will facilitate exchange, and something that's fungible. What might not be as obvious though is you also want it to be convenient and have a measure of freedom and anonymity, right? So that brings us to cryptocurrencies. What's a cryptocurrency? A cryptocurrency is a digital asset designed to work as a medium of exchange that uses strong cryptography to secure financial transactions, control the creation of additional units, and verify that transfer of assets. They're always decentralized, and many times they will use a blockchain. Why do I cover this? Because we're not covering cryptocurrencies. So I want to make sure you know what cryptocurrencies are, and make sure you understand that we are in no way, shape, or form covering cryptocurrencies today. So if you tuned in to hear about Bitcoin, sorry, wrong episode. We're not going to discuss that at all. So what are we going to discuss? We're going to discuss digital fiat currency. So let's distinguish a few things, because when we initially started talking about this, I know Stuart had some questions, let's say. So I think part of what we need to do here is distinguish between digitization of fiat currency and digital fiat currency, because they actually aren't the same thing. So federal notes are essentially money that your government owes you. The digits in your bank account are really representative of what your bank owes you. And that is not the same thing on multiple axes. So by changing to actual digital fiat currency, this kind of revised role, if you will, of the payment system would lead to individuals holding money at the central bank, not at a commercial bank. So there's been, I don't know what you want to call it for this conversation. Let's call it mobile money or e-money or whatever. This has been around for, at this point, decades almost. And it's backed by various trust accounts and it's not underpinned by a government. And that's what you need to understand. So there's no central bank involved. It is a representation of monetary value held at a private company. So as it stands today,
I'm going to play the role of the listener who doesn't know anything about this, just by coincidence.
Yep.
So $100 in your bank account, it's the bank's commitment to that money. It's not from the government. Digital fiat currency, that $100 would be with the central bank for your government, and it would be a direct commitment to the government, correct?
No, it would be issued by the central bank. So let me give you an example of what it would be now and if this existed. So now you have a pound or a dollar, whatever, which one of the two of you it may be, and you put that into PayPal or you put that into Venmo. That is not a physical dollar being stored at Venmo. It is Venmo's promise that you gave them a dollar. It is a Venmo dollar that is only spendable in a way that Venmo says it is spendable, and it's a private company.
Right.
When you spend it, Venmo bucks. If you spend it, they then convert it to a dollar, and you spend that dollar. What true digital fiat currency would be is a digital coin is created, and if you were to use Venmo, you would transfer that actual digital coin that was created at the central bank to Venmo, where it would still be digital fiat currency. It would not be Venmo bucks. It would be actual currency there. So from your perspective, Ack, the spend would not change from your end. In fact, it would be completely transparent, but the underpinnings would have very real consequences from in a whole bunch of ways.
So I understand this correctly. If I transfer some money into PayPal and then use PayPal to buy something on eBay,
yep.
What I'm actually doing is I say to PayPal, I've transferred some money. They just put a number in a database somewhere. And then when I buy a thing on eBay with my PayPal account, they're essentially deducting money from their own bank account to the amount. But with the digital stuff, I'm essentially transferring them a text file with a bunch of crypto bollocks in it because it's digital fiat currency, right? And then when I buy something on eBay with my PayPal account, they will transfer that same text file that I gave them to the end buyer. Essentially, correct. I mean, I'm glossing over a bunch of complexity here, obviously, but that's essentially the concept.
But conceptually, that is correct. Yes.
Okay.
Because one of the questions I had about this, when we were talking about this, and we said, okay, but so we'll have a digital fiat currency, is what the impact is on a real person. So we imagine we create a persona, right? Someone who's a consumer, a misunderstood English genius, red-haired guy, let's say, right?
Can we name that person?
I don't know, what should we call him? We'll call him Spewart or something, right?
okay, Spewart. Okay.
I don't know. Whatever. This completely anonymous, constructed digital persona that I've invented here. Currently, Spewart hardly ever handles cash, right? You go into a shop.
That's true. That's the tightest person I've ever met.
And you say, I'm sure Spewart would be very unhappy to hear himself described that way, Mr. Bacon. So you go into a shop and you say, okay, I'd like a pie of some description. And then you pay for it with contactless or by swiping a card or something like that. And then a digital transfer of money takes place. But if we had digital fiat currency, what you're saying is the experience of it would be the same. It's just that we'd actually be transferring actual strings of numbers around rather than just deducting one number from a database column and adding that same number to someone else's database column.
So I guess from a experience perspective, or if you consider that a workflow, it wouldn't change, but it would. So right now, when you do that, a private company knows what you've spent money on. If it were a digital coin, because it was issued by the central bank would have some visibility into what you're doing in a way that they don't now, unless the implementation was done a very specific way. So what you're seeing now is this isn't theoretical. A whole bunch of countries have actually done this. Some, like Ecuador, rolled it out in 2014 and decided it wasn't viable. A couple already have rolled it out, mostly smaller countries. Senegal is one of them, the Marshall Islands. And a couple larger countries are looking at it now. I think the two that are furthest along are Sweden and China. They're both taking pretty different approaches. So the implementation details here matter, especially if you consider a physical dollar or a physical pound is a bearer instrument, right? There's no ownership tied to it. If you possess it, it's yours. And once you give it to someone else and they possess it, it's theirs. So there is no trail. Outside of maybe England, where they can probably follow you on a CCTV camera everywhere. Outside of that, there's no real trail where, depending on how you implement a digital fiat currency in the way that China is looking to do so with the digital renminbi, they potentially would have visibility into everything. And that obviously comes with some pros as far as money laundering and crime. And it also has a whole bunch of cons. Privacy, anonymity, being respectful of your citizens. So, the details matter there.
Enlarging on the I transfer you a text file example was obviously oversimplified, slightly facetious, but presumably if I literally had a text file with a bunch of numbers in it, each one of which represented a digital pound, I could just go, okay. Oh, no, I couldn't. I couldn't just go, here is that number to you, because then I'd still have a copy of it. There's got to be some kind of actual transfer mechanism which something oversees, right?
Correct. That's where the centralization would come in, correct.
Right, so there has to be that central thing. You can't make it anonymous.
Oh, no, you absolutely could. If you look at how things like Monero or Zcash work, you could have the transfer of bits. So X amount got debited here, X amount got added here. So the double transaction system, just the money portion of it would be encoded. And there would be no concept of ownership throughout the entire system. And therefore, no way to not make it anonymous, if that makes sense.
Right, I mean, so...
But that's an explicit design decision.
This is something, again, that you probably need to unpack a bit. So, because as I understand it, the whole blockchain thing, it's anonymous in that you don't know that this particular... you can see that this particular account has done all these transactions on the blockchain, but you don't know it's my account.
Right, but, so if you look at how Bitcoin works, a wallet transfers BTC to a different wallet. And while the wallets are just a string of numbers, if you figure out whose wallet that was, you know who it was.
Yes. Does that also apply to this?
It depends. If, as a fundamental design decision, you choose not to encode the wallets into the transaction, then no.
Right. Okay. So
I see.
So it's possible to build this in a privacy-respecting way, but they don't have to.
Correct.
And presumably they have reasons to choose not to, other than just we violate people's privacy for lols.
So, I mean, now if you look at things like the Know Your Customer Act, which is a thing in the US, but I believe that's implemented pretty much around the world at this point, banks have a very real cost associated with opening accounts for things like money laundering and especially anti-terrorism activities. So you need quite a bit of information to open a bank account around identity and other things that make it difficult for some people to even open an account because you might not have that identity. Theoretically, if everything was traced all the way through, things like that wouldn't be an issue. So the unbanked, as they call them now, which tends to be, you know, the poorest of the poorer countries they consider unbanked, don't have access to a lot of the things that are required to open an account. Those kind of things you could get around at the cost of any amount of anonymity or really freedom. Because right now, when you spend money, it doesn't require permission. Where this would insert permission into the equation in a way that we don't fundamentally, it changes what money means in some ways.
Well, right. I was on that note, one of the things I want to understand here is the impact, putting the government, the privacy side to one side for a second, what about the impact, for example, on cash driven businesses, right? So for example, you know, there are, rightly or wrongly, there are hundreds of thousands of businesses around the world that receive payments in cash, right? And arguably, a significant reason for that is that they are not necessarily paying their taxes on those payments, right? Which obviously people should be paying their taxes, all the rest of it. But if you brought in a system like this, it's going to have a huge economic impact on those businesses. And while they should be paying tax, it's still going to have an economic impact on those businesses, I would have thought, because some of them, if they're literally living from check to check, they might not be able to then pay the taxes on the money that they're bringing in, because you're not going to fiddle your taxes when everything's going through the central system, right? So that's one element. But then the other element to me is, what about tipping?
Hang on. So let's treat that one element first and then go on to the next one. I have a certain amount of sympathy with what you're saying, but I feel like if you're trying to make the case to governments that the world only works because a bunch of people avoid taxation, and if you make taxation so much more efficient that people can't avoid taxation, you'll crater the economy. There are not that many governments will go, okay, then no worries. They're going to go, no, everyone should pay their damn taxes.
The comparison I would make is in certain parts of the US, especially in California, the amount of illegal immigration, like people who are hiring people who don't have visas to work in their businesses. Now, if you were to have one of those big claws that's in one of those arcade machines and was to come out of the sky and pick those people up and put them back in another country, even though those people should have gone through the legal immigration system, and there's lots of discussion around that, it would still have an impact on those businesses. So what I'm saying is, I'm not saying you shouldn't do this. What I'm saying is, I'd like to understand what will be the economic impact on those businesses, because a lot of those businesses may end up shutting down because they can't afford to pay the taxes.
So, I think it makes sense to unpack two ways, at least in my opinion. The first would be, I would not foresee any country ever going from where we are today to this in a day. It seems unlikely to me. I mean, some country might try it. Countries have done some pretty bonkers thing with their money. If you look at even the last 10 years, a couple countries have done some pretty surprising things. So there would be a point where they're printing digital fiat currency and fiat currency, and that would last for a while. But once the central bank has that real-time visibility and oversight into the entire platform, I suspect at least some countries would try to hedge down cash slowly and methodically. But
right.
To your point about the taxes, a lot of that's a concern that I definitely hear a lot and am sympathetic to. You look at a country like Sweden, though, over 80 to 85% of their transactions are already digital, and it has not had any adverse impact on businesses from what I have seen or having been there. Like, everyone uses Swish, and it's just a thing that everyone uses, and
it doesn't
seem to be a second thought to it. So maybe there's something novel about the Swedish economy that doesn't apply to some other places. I think countries like Germany are still super pro cash, Japan super pro cash. So how that would impact countries that have a more of a cash aspect kind of encoded into their idea of currency,
it
would be interesting. And I think this would definitely impact some people trust their governments pretty implicitly, and some people don't trust their governments at all. And I think that's going to also have a large impact on how these would be viewed.
Oh, huge. Yeah. Like, there's this kind of crowd out there of people who are super suspicious of the government. You know, they bury silver in their walls, and they have cans and cans of macaroni and cheese, and in case of the pandemic and all the rest of it. It's going to be very difficult to get
Sweden's on board with this. Swedish people tend to trust their government. People from Singapore tend to trust their government. People from the U.S., less so.
It'd be very difficult to bring this in the U.S. Like, yeah, I don't know. And the other thing as well would be, what about, I mean, look, this is by all means probably the narrowest element of this, but I just think about things like when you're when you go for a drink at a bar, just leaving, you know, a tip on the bar, and sure, you can tap it into the machine and all the rest of it, but there's something so personal about the action of, I think, like, whether you're giving some money to a busker or giving some money to some homeless people, who, like, a homeless person's not going to be there with a, you know, with a credit card scanner or something along those lines. Like, these are all big things.
There are already countries where you'll see buskers with QR codes next to them, and they want you to scan and pay them with Alipay or...
Oh, buskers, yeah. But homeless people, I'd be very surprised. Although I discovered recently that a lot of homeless people have cell phones, which I didn't know about. Didn't think that was a thing.
I mean, from my point of view, the problem with tipping is not necessarily that it feels so personal to do it. It's that if you include your tip as part of paying, then what happens is the restaurant owner trousers it, and the person who actually did half the work of carrying it out to you doesn't see dollar one.
Well, we don't know that.
We don't know it, but certainly I invite you to
we
go
have
and
no
ask.
Data to. I mean. But this is going to vary from restaurant to restaurant massively.
It's
by definition.
Yeah, of course it is. Absolutely. But you're eliminating the possibility.
Well, that's why I like tipping people with cash. Because
but that's exactly
if there
the
is
point.
Going to be, I don't want the owner getting it. Or,
yeah.
To me, what's even worse is, oh, well, we pool all the tips at the end of the night, and then Janine, who's shit at her job, has to get some money as well as, you know, Roger, who's really good at his job, however it works.
I think...
A lot of vitriol.
Both of your examples...
Strong tipping opinions.
...are interesting because they both suggest, both the a bunch of places... Don't necessarily pay all the tax they need to, and that's what keeps their business running, and things like tipping and so on. They both suggest that there's quite a lot of unregulated economic activity, which we kind of wink at, because if we really crack down on it hard, it'd screw everything up. And I think that's an extremely plausible story to tell. And as far as I can tell, one of the big promises with digital fiat currency is that it makes sure that everything's tracked and everything's above board and everything's in the ledger. And eliminates the possibility of doing things outside the big picture, precisely because otherwise your business would fall apart. And obviously there's quite a compelling story to be told to government or the central bank that, yeah, they definitely want insight into absolutely everything. But if you insist on everyone having insight into everything, it's, you've heard the phrase work to rule, right? Where someone does their job to the letter of the description of their job. And it's quite an effective alternative to a strike. Because if you actually go on strike, you don't get paid, or the union have to pay you out of union coffers, they have to pay you strike pay, which means that a strike can't go on for that long because the union runs out of money. But if everyone works to rule, you can't fire someone for doing their job as literally as possible, but it's got the same effect as a strike, which is that everything seizes up, right? And it feels a bit like the promise of digital fiat currency is that it makes all monetary transactions essentially happen on a work-to-rule basis. You know? Mm. Every T must be crossed and every I must be dotted. And if you do that, no one gets anything done because they spend all the time faffing around with money.
So once again, I think it depends a little bit on the implementation, I think. But I think part of why you're seeing a couple of countries move a little bit quicker than they had initially anticipated was the threat of something like Libra. If there were suddenly a fiat-ish currency that was well accepted and recognized by a whole bunch of people that was not controlled by a government, what does that mean for especially smaller governments who, you know, I think the U.S. is going to be a reserve currency for some amount of time. Currently, the renminbi is gaining some clout in that space as well.
Yeah.
But for some of the smaller currencies, if your government suddenly has no say in monetary policy because no one cares about your dollar anymore, they're just all using Libra. From a country's perspective, that's a pretty significant thing, which is why I think countries reacted so negatively to Libra. You're almost then turning Facebook in this case, but could be any company, into kind of a pseudo country.
Into a nation state,
right,
yeah.
Right. In a way, some of these large tech companies are almost becoming nation states, and this would be like the last thing needed to go from kind of ish to, no, Google's basically a country now.
Yeah, I mean, I said earlier that mining Bitcoin with your body energy was the most cyberpunk thing I'd ever heard. But no, the fragmenting the world up into corporations and countries not meaning anything anymore because it's all run by corporations, that's the most cyberpunk thing I've ever heard, because that's literally what all of cyberpunk is about. Question for you about the word fiat in fiat currency. Does the definition include it's a country? Like, I don't understand what, if Facebook had done Libra, I don't understand what doesn't make it a fiat currency, unless the definition of fiat currency is it has to be a government doing it. If someone who isn't a government does it, even if everyone on earth uses it, it's not fiat, because it's only fiat if governments do it.
So the strictest definition is currency without intrinsic value, but I think has been a presumption that the only one that could do this currently is a government, and it's possible that that's now changing.
Yeah, I think that's the point. I mean, up until relative, well, I don't know. I mean, could Standard Oil have done it in 1910? Maybe.
For their company towns, sure. Could you have gone anywhere?
But they did do it. There are a whole bunch of things that companies could. Ask Tennessee Ernie Ford, right? Wrote a whole song about it, 16 tons. But I think, yeah, I mean, a company now has a wider reach than it did before.
Yes.
But But what about moving to digital currency prevents Facebook from doing Libra?
So I don't think anything. The point being, though, if a digital currency caught on and was super popular before governments did it, there would be a case to just use that and not worry about the governments having done it.
Right. So, but then we come back to my question about our redheaded Web Lothario in England, right? Because our person on the ground floor is not actually seeing any fundamental difference in their activity by going to digital currency. The reason you'd go to Libra is not because, oh, it's digital and I like the idea of digital currency. It's because it's way more convenient to pay with or something like that. And that applies even if the Bank of England roll the pound sterling into digital currency tomorrow. And the perfect example of this is that I think you would agree that, for example, contactless payment is way more convenient for most things than grabbing around in your pocket for dollar bills, or even paying with a card and then signing a little bit of paper, whatever. And yet there's been hardly any adoption in America. And as far as I can tell, that's not because people don't want it. It's because banks don't want it. And, you know, so Apple and Google are deliberately trying to bring this stuff in and route all the payments through them, not because, well, I mean, obviously they'd like a piece of every payment that goes out in the world, but Bank of America could do it. They just don't seem to want to. The reasons escape me completely.
So I think you bring up an interesting point here, and the kinds of organizations that are going to be the most anti-digital fiat currency are banks and other financial institutions for a couple reasons. One, where does this leave someone like MasterCard or Visa? If what you're doing is exchanging money and suddenly that's built into the system, you don't really have the leverage to seek rents in a way that you do now. But the bigger one is, I don't know how much you know about how kind of the current banking system works, but a bunch of it is a whole wide swath of people put a bunch of money into banks, and with that money, they lend money out, but they need to keep a certain amount in reserve. So by having a large depository situation, you can do other things with that money and create value through interest and through loans and through other things. But the whole system really is built on a cheap source of liquid funds coming from everyone. If suddenly your digital fiat currency is from the central bank and you don't need to store it anywhere, suddenly banks don't have access to capital in a way that they do now, because it doesn't exist in the way that it does now. So the most impacted, this is why this is kind of a fundamental sea change in a way that isn't immediately obvious, is the way the economic system works now from at multiple different layers would be completely wiped out and changed in a way that would have super long-term ramifications for not only banks, but transaction companies and a whole bunch of tiers in between.
That's really interesting. So the central bank wants this because there's a whole bunch of big picture economic stuff that's a good idea. Plus, they get insight into every payment that happens everywhere, which they like the idea of. Banks don't want it because it basically cuts them out of the loop, because no one needs to deposit money there anymore.
Right.
Influential people who hide their tax money abroad and do money laundering don't want it because they'll get caught. Right. Normal people on the ground floor don't care one way or the other because it doesn't actually affect their lives in any significant way. So it comes down to banks versus
It may indirectly affect their lives, though. Well, it may, and I want to get into the...
Go ahead.
The international money trading piece and the transfers piece, I think we should get into, because while I agree with you, Ak, that, you know, the average person is not going to be storing their money in Puerto Rico, wherever, you know, where it is to get around taxes and whatever else, they may be investing, for example, in a fund in the stock market, or they may have, as part of their 401k, people who are investing and using some of those tricks to get around it. And I'd be curious to see what the impact of this will be having on those international transfers. Like, I don't know if anyone saw the documentary about the Panama Papers. It's unbelievable. Yeah. And it's just horrifying what goes on in this particular area. What do you think, Jeremy, will be the impact of this? Because a lot of businesses are probably already keeping their money offshore. Would this affect them?
Yeah, so once again, it would come down to the implementation. If a country chose to go with an implementation that tried to mirror the anonymity of paper currency, then it would almost be unchanged. If a country went with an implementation where, like, look at what China's probably going to do, given the information that's come out so far, and especially I think China is a pretty good example, because they have really strict currency controls on what you can and cannot bring out of the country. So if they were able to codify into the system that was suddenly a thing, as opposed to trying to catch people with massive amounts of paper money leaving, those are two way different things. So I think it could have huge ramifications, or it could have none, depending on the implementation details matter. And because no large countries have done this yet, there's kind of no precedent. So that's why I think people are watching Sweden. People are kind of watching what China does to see what happens there. And if it's super popular, that's, I think, one thing that would be concerning is if a country goes with a non-privacy respecting one and it becomes popular, other central banks will probably follow. So it's something that I think to keep an eye on what some of these countries are doing, because while it won't likely impact you, Stuart, or Jono, you and I, in the next couple of years, it seems inevitable that it will impact us at some point. But I would guess the US and the UK will be late adopters of this, not early adopters.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that kind of, as we kind of edge this towards the finish line, what do we think the likelihood of this will be becoming a thing that people actually, because right now it seems like this is largely something that, you know, economics nerds are talking about. But what do you think the likelihood, Jeremy, is of this becoming something that, to a reasonable extent, could become like a serious experiment that could turn into a serious thing that people have to think about?
So like I said, Senegal, Marshall Islands, already doing it. Sweden, the e-krona, they're doing a test in the next year or two. China, same thing with the renminbi. So it's not something theoretical, but this is happening for sure. Whether it goes like it did in Ecuador and they find that it isn't something that they want to do, or it is, I think remains to be seen. And part of it is going to be adoption, and part of it's going to be how they implement it. But it seems inevitable that more countries are going to try this.
You can totally see.
To talk about.
Yeah. And you can absolutely see the attraction from the government, right? See the attraction. So it wouldn't surprise me if there are, like, the US government, if they were to do an experiment in this, it would piss off a lot of people in the US, but I can see them pushing hard to get this through. And it wouldn't surprise me at all as if you'd actually have a lot of unification on both sides of the fence with this, because the people on the left are going to be happier about probably people paying taxes more fairly to a reason. I mean, the whole, you know, the breakdown of the different taxing levels is a separate question, but the fact that people will, there'll be a system where you'll be able to track your income more effectively and pay taxes on it. And on the right, I'm guessing a big push here will be about reducing crime and, you know, and that level of control over what people are buying. So it's almost certainly going to become a thing, right?
But equally, there's going to be a whole bunch of people on the left who are like, well, we don't want, you know, that our privacy is important and so on.
Big brother,
And you got a whole bunch of people on the right who are already unhappy about the fact that every time they buy a Budweiser, they've got to pay with a thing with the Secretary of the Treasury's signature on it. Because they're sovereign citizens, don't you know? It's going to excite a lot of... In order to do this, the technical implementation of how you do it is obviously important, and the method you take. And there's also one of my big concerns is this would be the biggest IT project in the history of the universe. And if you were to say, who's really good at doing IT projects, I would not say the government.
No, not really.
You would?
So... I would not. They're capable of doing great things.
So does this make you feel better or worse? And this is true. I'm not making this up. The company picked to build the e-krona for Sweden, Accenture.
Oh, this is what I'm saying, right? And that makes me feel worse. Yes, it does. But we knew that.
Who's surprised that Accenture were picked for that?
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I mean, that's there's got to be someone who nailed down that deal sitting there going, okay, lads, before we got to just build a thing which everyone in the country had to sign into, whatever. I mean, yeah, it took 2 years and cost $400 million. Now we get to tamper with the very concept of money itself and then store that data in Microsoft SQL Server. Hurrah.
The only detail that matters is they better use Microsoft SQL Server.
You know what I think is fascinating about this, though? Earlier on, when Jeremy was giving everybody the crib sheet on just currency in general, I think it's easy for most of us to forget that the numbers that you see in your bank account are not real numbers. That the bill that you've got in your pocket is not really a real number. I think it's easy, and a lot of people in the world... assume that for that $1 in their pocket, although that £1 in their pocket, there is a corresponding something somewhere that corresponds to that value in some shape or form. And I think that this is a very complicated subject to get over to our listeners who are inherently curious, technical people, but for the general public...
And
who
are smarter than most other people, and indeed better looking than,
incredibly
than
good,
other podcast
incredibly
listeners.
Good. Oh, amazing. Better than all of those other stupid, horrible podcasts. But, you know, for all of those people out there, for example, who are currently drinking bleach to deal with the coronavirus... I don't know how you explain this. Like, this is such a complicated subject.
So
it's like explaining a life without oxygen. Like, it's just...
If this is a topic that interests you, there is a really good case study that I think is pretty approachable. It's a little bit of a long read. It is an actual case study, but it's called The Case for Digital Legal Tender, Central Bank Issued Digital Currency and Its Impact on Financial Inclusion. It's a free PDF that's available. I can give I'll give the link to ACT included in the show notes. Really genuinely interesting read. Super, super
cool.
Educational, I think, if this is a topic that interests you, because it is a little commitment to read the whole thing. There is also a pretty good intro and a pretty good conclusion if you want to just skim. But some pretty detailed information in there as well.
So this is prime Bad Voltage community discussion fodder. Go to the Slack channel. Go and let us know what you think. Do you think this is a good idea? Would you be happy if this came in? Do you think it could happen in your country? Let us know which country you're in, because we have people from all over the world who listen to the show.
So I would be especially interested if we do have any listeners in the Marshall Islands, Tunisia, or Senegal who have already adopted it, or any in Ecuador who adopted it and it went poorly. Would be super interested to hear what your experience was, if you have any thoughts. I mean, I don't know how many people are listening in the Marshall Islands, given how many people live in the Marshall Islands, but would be excellent to hear from you.
You never know. You never know. Yeah, cool. All right. Well, I guess that's it. So anything else you guys want to talk about before we wrap this lovely episode up?
No,
I'm good. Share? Are you speaking anywhere? Probably not speaking anywhere in the next 2 weeks, I'm guessing.
I have already done an online conference talk today, and I'm doing another one when the show finishes. So
how was SplortCon?
Really annoyingly, the conference is called Go to Chicago, and the one thing I didn't do was go to Chicago, which made me quite sad, because I was quite looking forward to going to Chicago, and now I don't get to go. So I'll just have to get a pizza and then drown it in tomato sauce by myself.
That's not, so Chicago pizza, delicious. As a New Yorker, not pizza.
What is this whole deal with New Yorkers have got such a weird obsession about that they're the best pizza? I've had way better pizza outside of New York than inside of New York. And I know what he's going to say. Well, you've not had the right pizza. Go on.
I'm sure California Pizza Kitchen is delicious.
I feel like people in actual Naples would take issue with this whole idea that New Yorkers think they own the concept of pizza.
Oh, man. The best pizza I've ever had was in Florence. Good grief.
Yeah, Florence so and good. Rome both have amazing pizza, to be honest.
Amazing.
So I'm on board with good alternative pizza. It's fine.
Wow, that was the most dismissive thing ever. I'm really impressed.
Is it Chicago where the Avia is?
Yes.
Is that in Chicago? Thought so. So amazing cocktail bar. I've not been there. Jeremy's been there.
This is the place my daughter was going on about, I think. Because
she's owned by Ackett, who is he does Alinea as well, one of the better restaurants around.
Yeah, she was because she was terribly annoyed that I got to go to Chicago and she didn't, and she was like, "You have to go to this place and then tell me about it." And now I'm like, "Lol, not going."
You would definitely gone to that place, I imagine, but no.
Yeah, they have they have a cookbook that we just bought recently. I know Jeremy's got it.
I do,
and it's $85 for this book. Also, it is not a cookbook, because no one's going to go and acquire a quail egg to make a fucking cocktail, okay? It's so complicated, these recipes.
The drinks are outrageously complicated, but the book is super cool and about half the price of an actual drink in aviary, so it's great.
All right. It is one of the most beautiful objects I've ever purchased is that cookbook. Photography
it's really a cool
astonishing.
Book.
Yeah.
If you drop $85 on a book about cocktails and everything, you don't really want to open it up. It says the first one is vodka and Dr. Pepper, and that's the end.
That would be brilliant, actually, if someone makes a cookbook of just the complete trash, but with amazing beautiful
I'll tell you,
imagery.
Somewhere on my list of dreams, if my six numbers come up or whatever, I'm gonna. You know how you go to a restaurant and you think, oh, there's so much stuff and I can't decide which to pick it. I'm going to open a restaurant and you open the menu, it just says egg and chips. And that's literally all you sell. Just one thing. That's just all you do. And there's none of this decision paralysis about the menu. You just open the thing and it just says, you know, meatloaf. Or, I mean, or it could be, you know, noisettes of lamb and a red wine coolie if you like, right? Just one thing is the point.
You know what, kids? Stay in school, because you too can have big dreams like Mr. Langridge.
I like my dreams. They're great. Right, okay, that's the end of the show.
Nice.
Thank you very much for listening.
See you later.